Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to introduce you to Sergey Netesyan, Senior Vice Dean of Innovation and Global Initiatives at the Wharton School. Is a Durbani Armani Professor of Innovation and Entrepreneurship. But more importantly, he's not just a professor. He is an AI expert at Amazon, and he's an investor. Sergey, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me, Alex. Great to be here.
Well, I have to start with two disclosures. I'm a proud Wharton alum, and recently I got to know Sergey as he's invested in Relate2 AI, and you know, I wanted to share the wonder and excitement that I had from having him on board and engaging with him with all of you, because in my head, this is the sort of the penultimate role of business faculty today, is to be on the bleeding edge of innovation. To actually apply what the scholarship is, to reinvent themselves because they are under pressure to do so. And Sergey will tell us how he is bringing Wharton in across the ages, and also put their money where their mouth is and like back innovations and actually be a valued added contributor to these innovations. And so Sergey, you know, you have a very unique, in my view, role. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how you've assembled it and how it came about that you have so many hats at Wharton?
Certainly, yeah. We as professors at top business schools, we are in a fortunate position that we are pretty flexible in what we do. There are people who start companies. I actually have several of my colleagues at Wharton, actually both on several, who start companies, who invest in companies. There are people who decide to edit academic journals or write books and go into kind of a guru speaking gigs. I have several faculties who, for example, do litigation consulting and serve as expert witnesses and so on. So I have a big administrative role at Wharton as a senior vice dean. So I lead our international or global strategy, and I also lead innovation, which is to say that I'm trying to figure out what new business models our business school should have 10, 20 years from now, because we see certain trends, we see customer tastes kind of changing, so we need to react to that as well. And then outside of Wharton, I'm an investor. I actively participate in a couple of venture capital funds. And I also work at Amazon as Amazon Scholar, which is kind of a unique position that Amazon created for academics like me who come and just spend one day a week, or some spend longer. I spend just one day a week helping Amazon with strategy, with data, with you know, also vision, with public policy. I spent some time mostly on public policy in the past. I actually managed even to write a paper at Amazon based on my work. So that's kind of a number of things that I'm trying to do at the same time.
So which of these are, let's start with some of the most controversial ones. And you know, so we'll come back to Amazon, because I think obviously that's interesting and fascinating how you're applying your academic expertise there. But you know, the idea of Wharton being the original business school, having achieved, you know, a great degree of success in the undergraduate, MBA, exec ed, PhD programs, and so on. And I know that one of your projects is to start earlier You want to tell us a little bit about that? Because I think I would have loved that program when I was earlier in my in discovering what business is all about.
Yeah, so one program, and this is kind of one of the innovations that I lead at Wharton. We started what we call Wharton Global Youth Program. And nowadays you can go to Wharton's front page and you'll see it right at the top. Among other programs, we have Global Youth. And the idea is to educate children who are 15 to 19 years old on business topics, entrepreneurship, finance, what have you. We launched this just a few years ago, 5 years ago, and it basically doubles in size every year, growing very, very quickly. What's kind of remarkable, we are the only business school that seriously addresses this market. There are other schools that have like a course or two in summer, but we have massive high school programs with online courses, in-person courses, investment competition, data science competition. We do a lot of philanthropy programs, so we kind of have a whole scope of programs for high school students, and this is a highly underappreciated market. About 60 million kids every year apply to business schools for undergraduate programs, and what prepares them? Nothing. Our schools or any schools in the world, they don't really teach about business, so kids have a very one-sided view of business. Business is business, and then they come to us. We tell them that, look, there is marketing, there is accounting, there is finance, there is entrepreneurship, there are all kinds of different lines of business, different industries. We get them interesting speakers, industry speakers, faculty speakers. We put them in dorms, in the same dorms as our undergraduate students are staying. And that creates kind of a preview of this college experience that they will have in the future. Again, massive market, huge demand. We get many, many applications, way more than we can accommodate. Greatly overlooked, and we believe in the future we're going to start early. I'm looking at mid-school market and maybe at elementary school market at some point. Imagine teaching young kids about your money. Understanding loans and mortgages and how to think about paying for college and so on. I think this can start very, very early.
Wharton edition of Monopoly coming up.
Yeah.
That's good. And I couldn't agree more with what you're producing. I noticed that, for example, my son, he likes, like, there's a Game of Life equivalent where, there is some financial things involved. He kind of got into it. Like, he liked playing. And, like, imagine you could playing in things that actually make you understand how the world works, how the economy works. And I think that's a wonderful gift that a parent could provide. And I would say that there is the competition that I kind of encountered as a high school student was something called junior achievement, which was like teaching us about entrepreneurship. And I thought that was a great, like, it was very particular direction. And so it probably was not the classical, business education for everyone, but I think that was there's a huge opportunity. There's definitely room for trusted expertise of Wharton, to deliver that experience because the regular high school programming, I would imagine, is kind of leaves much to be desired in that department.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you're right. There are organizations that teach kind of business or business adjacent subjects. Like DECA is pretty big. Most schools in the United States participate in DECA, but there are no brands. There are no like big brands like Wharton, Stanford, Harvard. Somehow most schools barely even touch undergraduate level. We have undergraduate program. No other Ivy League, for example, has undergraduate program. Stanford doesn't have undergraduate program. We do. And so when high school students think about business education, first they think about, okay, what is the best undergraduate business school? And that's us typically. In any ranking you look at it, our undergraduate program, which you went through, has always been ranked number one and will always be ranked number
It
one.
lowered the year I graduated a little bit, but then it recovered. I'm glad to say.
I hope not. I hope not. And so, they naturally gravitate to us. They come to our websites, they explore, and so on. And so we get actually a lot of organic traffic. We don't even need to advertise all that much our high school programs. And by now, we enrolled several thousand students online and in person. We grew and started in San Francisco because Bay Area is a huge market. We now have high school programs in Cambridge, UK. We are starting in Oxford as well. We are launching a program in Dubai this January. So we are starting to grow throughout the world because, frankly, demand is unprecedented, especially in emerging economies as well. You know, China, India, South America, you name it.
That's brilliant. And I like again, I think it's a real gift. And you're absolutely right. There was no there's no rival to Wharton in the undergraduate concept. Like somebody even told me, like, well, I kind of want to do business and I heard this thing, Ivy League thing is good. So like, where do I go? And they're like, well, the obvious. So like I was one of those early decision Wharton people. And I believe that what you're offering is a great platform, especially as I think, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, I think there's more and more kind of appetite for people to start their entrepreneurial journeys earlier. So acquiring some basic, you know, basic economic and, you know, financial acumen is only going to help, you know, great technology founders and other founders, like other people with an entrepreneurial DNA, to go and unlock that sooner. So, what other initiatives are you pushing besides that you know you think will change the game for the business education going forward?
So another initiative that we launched just last year is what we call Wharton Academy. And the idea is to give undergraduate students from other institutions or from University of Pennsylvania who are not Wharton majors, not business majors, to give a short non-degree, non-credit business classes. And this could be like a 2, 3 week courses on AI, for example, in business, could be also entrepreneurship classes, could be finance, data science. And there we are targeting the trend that we are seeing that there is less and less demand for degree education and more demand for non-degree. So people beginning to prefer short non-degree classes, which you can take throughout your life. So, you know,
Some sort of
hopefully.
credential, but it's not a full-on degree.
Yeah, hopefully stackable credential, but yeah, badges, certificates of all sorts. And you know, the logic is, you know, degree education is expensive and it's kind of a little static, right? So what if you learn something and then a few years later you realize that this is not a marketable skill or something else popped up like AI, for example. So we are hoping to attract non-business majors who realize that, hey, you know, to get a job, I actually need some marketable skills, business skills, or someone who maybe graduated a few years back, maybe from, you know, a good institution, but in another country, and wants to get a taste of what the best business school feels like. So we also put them in dorms in summer, and we deliver these classes in person. So that's something we are trying out. Our hypothesis is that's going to be a new kind of a space where a lot of new demand is going to happen.
It's kind of like what used to be the study trip to Oxford or to Paris, you know, now is becoming kind of a study trip to Pan Campus, and then you get
Yeah.
like, you know, you get a life experience and an accreditation as a result of that.
Yeah,
Brilliant.
that's a hope. Yeah.
Now
So
tell me
that's
a
yet
little bit.
another
That's
innovation.
another one. So where in kind of applying that innovation straight into the industry. So you've done consulting with a number of great companies, and now, as you mentioned, at Amazon. How does that work? And you know, what attracts, besides, you know, getting access to your brain power, what attracts kind of organizations like Amazon to go deeply in, you know, in collaborations to create the special role, even you know, for part-time academics, right? Not a full-time
Yeah,
degree.
I think so. This is something that is very unique to Amazon. I haven't seen similar programs at other companies. Many companies hire academics, you know, Microsoft and Airbnb and Uber and so on, but they all hire full time. And so some professors kind of take a sabbatical and try it. Some just quit their daytime job as an academic and join those companies. I had some colleagues who now work at Airbnb and Uber and Netflix and other companies. But Amazon had this, for many years, had this need to recruit academics. And they found it very, very difficult because, you know, most academics, they are risk averse. They don't really like working for business. They like their tenured jobs and so on. So at some point, there was a new chief economist at Amazon, Pat Bahari, who recently passed away, unfortunately. And he was a professor at Stanford for many years and then Minnesota and so on. And he joined Amazon full time as a VP and the chief economist. And he had this insight. He said, like, look, to recruit academics, you have to start slow. You should hire them, you know, once, one day a week, then maybe some of them will do it full time in summer, then maybe others will take sabbatical and do it for a year, and then slowly some of them will join Amazon full time. So I think that was kind of the whole idea, which worked really well. So now we have hundreds of Amazon scholars at Amazon. I was one of the few ones 6 years ago. One of the first ones, and so many of them actually converted. Many of them decided to work at Amazon full time, and now I have colleagues who are directors and VPs at Amazon who are former academics and decided to quit, and they just liked it, right? So I tend to like my daytime job at Wharton a lot. So you know, I have no plans of doing that, but I find it really interesting working in a highly diverse group of academics. Like in my team, I have a Nobel laureate in economics. So that's kind of exciting. You know, I don't really, on a daily basis, I don't work with Nobel laureates in economics. You know, in my bigger team, we had someone who invented machine learning. You know, we have physicists, we have computer scientists, we have statisticians, you know. And so it's really, really cool to see how they think about everyday problems of Amazon and kind of contribute how I think.
And so is there anything that you could share with us that gets, that sort of, you mentioned there are some public papers that you've written that gives us an insight into, you know, the academically rigorous big picture challenges that you're tackling? So that we could see where the two worlds connect.
Certainly. So paper is public, it's published, so I can talk about it. So I spent a lot of time at Amazon thinking about public policy, which is trying to evaluate economic impact of Amazon on the economy. And this is very often kind of underappreciated how much Amazon contributes. So we've been trying to do various studies, like what happens when Amazon warehouse gets built, you know, how does the community, how does county benefit? And at some point we collected enough evidence that we decided to publish a paper. So I co-authored the paper, which basically shows when Amazon warehouse is built in a county, employment goes down, employment goes up, I'm sorry, employment goes up, poverty goes down, and average median incomes increase. And we find a very significant job multiplier for very jobs that Amazon brings directly. There is another job created indirectly, probably in delivery, in logistics, and you know, last mile, but also construction workers get hired and maintenance workers get hired and employees at the warehouse need to eat. So so there are lots of kind of infrastructure around the warehouse. So that kind of, in short, is a paper that we published. And we created lots of other research on various other impacts of Amazon, for example, in disaster relief and, you know, various kind of other aspects. So that's kind of important for public to know. I think that some of the big companies contribute in a major way to the economy, because very often public has kind of a very negative view of big companies and doesn't realize how much economic value is created.
So by basically taking over some of the functions that were historically done, for example, by postal services, there's also a public benefit that, you know, comes with that, you know, and it sounds like, you know, Amazon is, you know, taking that very responsibly. And I think actually I was very impressed with some of the statements from Bezos a while back, just about, you know, yes, we're responsible. We do need to take a responsibility. We do need to be evaluated and monitored and measured on this thing. So I always felt like there's sort of this notion of disruption, and you're a professor of innovation, but I also feel like was the opportunity to disrupt comes a lot of responsibility, and the smarter businesses take that very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are so many aspects in which Amazon really kind of changed the face of economy. And, you know, it essentially created a completely new type of job, this kind of a distribution center, logistic distribution center job. I mean, those jobs existed before Amazon, but they were very few. You know, the number of them just skyrocketed when Amazon started building warehouses, and very often people who get hired in those centers, they have no prior experience, no training. They're young, it's their first job coming out of school. For many of them, they were previously unemployed. Amazon established a minimal wage, which is way higher than, you know, federal minimal wage, double of federal minimal wage. Long time ago, you know, it gives you benefits. It actually pays for your tuition, for your education.
That's the part that I think is really relevant, like to also you being like the I when I heard about the tuition benefits of that, they were tremendous. They were like the equivalent of what you know Army, you know, Navy were providing back in the you know, as part of their kind of value proposition as well. So that this is a I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and then there is like, you know, health benefits and insurance and so on. So there are many, many benefits that people don't realize that these are like good jobs. And there is a million of those jobs. So Amazon is like a second biggest employer in US, I think, after Walmart. So, you know, I think public needs to know about these benefits.
Well, and obviously the counter narrative in the public today, the fear about AI taking some of these jobs away. Mm-hmm. Not maybe the Amazon jobs, but, you know, whatever the discipline where there is increasingly a need for automation, and, you know, robotic automation is part of that. What's your take on that, being, you know, close to the impact on the communities and having taken academic rigor, whether it's through the Amazon lens or the Wharton lens?
I think if I think about this as an academic, we've had many of these waves of technological innovation where there was fear that jobs are going to go away. My favorite example is ATM. So ATMs came out a long time ago, I think in 70s, 80s. And at the time, there were 25,000 bank tellers in the United States. And the headlines in newspapers were, okay, these 25,000 jobs are now going away because ATMs are giving out cash, and so you don't need tellers. You know how many bank tellers we have right now? 75,000. You know, so it just, those tellers don't give cash anymore. They moved on to other jobs, you know, the all kinds of loans, CDs, and refinancing, and, you know, all kinds of other more high-end jobs. So it's good for people because these are more high-end jobs. They are more interesting than just counting cash, right? And it's good for banks because, you know, ATMs are more productive. So I think this is what's going to happen with AI, in my view. Sure, there's going to be some very mundane, many routine tasks which are going to be automated by AI, and we will not have to do them. But there's going to be plenty of new jobs created, more interesting jobs. Like for Amazon, for example, one of the limitations of Amazon warehouses, you have to locate them where you can find employees because you need several thousand people working there, right? So that means essentially you cannot locate in the middle of nowhere. And you know, there could be people living in the middle of nowhere who want products, but you cannot hire enough employees to work there. So that's a perfect example for a robotic warehouse, for example, you know. And there are plenty of more sophisticated jobs at Amazon where people can move up to, you know, say delivery drivers, right? That's much more interesting. You drive around, you deliver, it's actually much higher paid. So maybe that's the kind of rebalancing that is going to happen.
So on that note, and I think this rebalancing broadly speaks to this tension between both technology innovation, which is what we talked about, but also business model innovation. And obviously Amazon combined both. You're the world authority on business model innovation And I'm just going to read out a few of the quotes that I love picked up from you from various speeches and books. So companies must be willing to selectively forget the past and even destroy their own icons. Why are you confident that business model innovation is less risky than new product development? And what skepticism do you hear the most about this topic?
So business model innovation emerged probably in the last, I don't know, I would say 10, 15 years is kind of a major thread. And Clayton Christensen at Harvard wrote something about business model innovation, and then it kind of took off from there. I had one of the earlier books on business model innovation, which I published in 2014 with Harvard Business Press. To me, this is an often underappreciated kind of a innovation topic. If you look, for example, at big companies, many of them or most of them would have a R&D department. R&D department run by, chief of R&D or chief innovation officer. And typically R&D departments employ engineers, and they focus on technology innovation, they focus on product innovation. I very rarely see companies that have any kind of structure set up for business model innovation. And to me, that's a big kind of a
What about
missing
McKinsey
component.
and Oliver Wyman and all these guys that come in and get paid? Like, we were doing these projects, and I would say that's obviously outsourcing something that's hyper strategic. Is that what you're finding is the kind of the key?
To me, every company needs to set up a process by which business model innovation happens. And it has to be done by people within the organization, people coming from all kinds of lines of business, because business model is combined of, operations part and sales part and marketing part and so on. So all these people have to come together and as a team analyze the current business model and come up with kind of what's wrong with this business model, and then think about what the next business is going to be like. It's almost impossible for an outsider to come in and say, here is a new business model. You just don't know enough of everyday details of what goes on at the company to create a new business model. And in my experience, McKinsey's of the world, they don't create the process for you. They come, they do kind of a one-off innovation most of the time. But what you need is like every year, like you review your financial statements, for example, every quarter, every year. The same way, you need to have a process by which you review your business model, audit it, and then come up with a new business model. And this should really start at the very top with the board, where the board has to tell the CEO, like, look, we have a current business model. One of your jobs is to run the current business model, but the second job is to tell us what the next business model is going to look like. So you have two jobs. That's kind of how it should work in my view.
And are you finding that the companies that are most successful at doing this, they have these skunk work departments and almost independent business units to go and try to reinvent things, or do they manage to bring it as a process inside their core operations and fight the incentives that those organizations have to continue status quo growth rates?
I don't think there is a one approach that fits everyone. I've seen companies that have a separate business model innovation department. For example, I worked with Medtronic business model innovation unit at some point. And Medtronic's, it's a healthcare company. It has very, very complicated products, like pacemakers, very, very expensive. So at some point they realize that for every product like that, you need a different business model to commercialize it, to sell it. But I think most companies don't need that. I think most companies can get by with fluid teams, which get formed every year to review the current business model, come up with ideas for a new business model, and then launch a bunch of experiments with business models. And that can be run independently by business units, or you can assign a person to oversee those experiments. So I think most companies don't need a fixed business model innovation department, in my view.
So when I was at SuccessFactors, or sort of SAP role, I kind of tried to wear that hat, kind of launching new businesses within. They were either supplementary or they had a kind of a chance to kind of mix things up. And I always found that the skill involved in kind of pulling that off was a very unusual set of things, right? You needed to at the same time be a coalition builder and be trusted within the existing infrastructures, but they needed to have a little bit of a crazy entrepreneurial kind of break some rules and ask for forgiveness later type of mindset. What are you finding is the persona that is able to pull these projects off within these large institutions, right? Is it former founders? Is it people who always wanted to be founders, but are kind of institutionally sound? Like, you know, any traits that you seem are great for people that want to pull that off inside their organization?
Well, hopefully, most big organizations have this kind of a more innovative thinkers, either chief innovation officer or chief information officer. Some companies, and more of them, decide to collaborate with startups on this. And this, I think, this is a very, very fruitful approach. I recently wrote a big report on corporate startup collaboration, and you see more and more of this. You see, OpenAI and Microsoft, you see Anthropic and Amazon and so on. So there is kind of a more and more realization that you can bring this craziness and energy of startup founders from outside. And then there are various ways to collaborate with startups. For example, what we see in the report, one of the kind of a recent emerging practices is corporate venture clienting, where a corporation becomes kind of a client for a startup. And for example, I'm a bank. I want to offer some innovative AI service to my customers. I go to startups that offer something like that, and I tell them, like, look, here is a subset of customers. I'm willing to open them for you and offer your service for a while and see how it works. You experiment this way, and you conclude, like, yeah, that works. So let's now offer it to all of our customers. And if it doesn't work, you can always apologize and say, like, look, sorry, this was just a startup service. We kind of tried, it didn't work, we shut it down, right? So something like that can also work really well, and we see it happening all over the place.
You brought up AI, and obviously with AI, there is all sorts of questions around business model innovation in the software industry itself. So there's a legacy kind of waves of innovation. There was on-premise software. You know, I was very fortunate to be part of a cloud software wave with SuccessFactors and Salesforce. And now we're seeing, obviously an AI first wave. You could say maybe mobile, social, but we're somewhere in there as well. But like, let's say AI is the new wave, and the pricing and the business model components are sort of shifting, right? On the one hand, everybody understands that it's easy to charge per person, software subscriptions. But on the other hand, the value unlocked by AI companies is different. And there's examples of already snowflakes in the world that had this sort of utility-based pricing. So what are your thoughts on what are the biggest risks in this transition? For legacy vendors, even for new vendors, of like, hey, we got something great and it's very innovative, but it's super confusing. And, people end up not using the service fully because we kind of started to get too creative with our business model. And, how do you balance those trade-offs?
So two thoughts here. So one is that we are still in very, very early stages. So nobody knows what really works, what business models with AI work. And I think a lot of public's media attention is on this large LLMs, Anthropics and OpenAIs and so on. Which I think is natural at this stage, but my hypothesis is that much more innovation is going to happen not there. So there's going to be a few of those large language models they will become kind of a commodity. You can connect to this one or to that one, it doesn't really matter. Where I think a lot of innovation is going to happen is at the edge, at the Internet of Things, at robotics devices, and so on. And the way AI in these places works right now is really stupid. So, for example, your thermostat on your wall is going to send a signal to OpenAI, and there's going to be some computation happening, and then there's going to be a signal back to say increase temperature by 1 degree. That's literally what happens. It's also what happens in robotics, where there is a robotic arm that sends signal to the cloud, and then command comes back. That's super inefficient, requires huge compute, huge power, goes through all kinds of wires, needs to be connected to the internet. I think the future is going to be at a small scale AIs, which is sitting in your car, in your thermostat, in your fridge, in your robotic arm, and they do a very fast, efficient compute using much, much smaller models. For example, Amazon naturally is trying to do something like this with Alexa. Alexa right now sends data back and forth, which is gigabytes of data. That's not optimal. What you want to have is small power consumption chip that sits at the edge, doesn't share any data with the cloud, so your privacy is protected and so on. How business models are going to emerge for those kinds of applications, this is very hard to tell. I think it's going to be some combination of, monthly subscriptions, but also there's going to be unlocking of some features. Because kind of a more complicated features require more compute. Maybe they require talking to the cloud, for example, and that's not costless. So this is one thing that we learned with AI. Software used to be pretty costless to do all kinds of, manipulations, but AI is not costless. AI is very, very expensive. So at some point, we'll have to try to take that into account and to monetize AI somehow based on how much compute you do, right? But these small models that sit at the edge, that sit at the Internet of Things, they probably can be just monthly subscription that comes with your device.
I love these insights, and I'm curious, how do you introduce these into your own investment decisions, where you put your hard-earned, Wharton and consulting, income into backing startups like us, or funds that are having more of a, broader portfolio strategy? What informs your decisions and and choices, from both academic work, practical work, or even your inner self, and kind of how do you choose where to invest your resources, and then your time as well, which is kind of very
Yeah, I'm a very strange investor
important.
because I actually don't care about returns on my investment, honestly. For me, it's much more a way to learn, to see some interesting examples and incorporate them in my teaching, for example, to write about those examples in my books and my articles. Also maybe to bring it to class and maybe bring it to the business units that I run at Wharton. So I have all kinds of ulterior motives. And so I will not do as most kind of investors, the due diligence in terms of, okay, what ROI can I get? How much money can this bring and how big is the market? So in that sense, I'm probably not your typical investor. This is just a way for me to enhance what I do in teaching and research. For example, I wrote a bunch of papers using data from startups, and I love using startups as sources of data because big companies are painful. They bring lawyers, they sign NDAs, it's just impossible to work with them. 5 years later, you are still like signing
Getting in trouble.
NDAs with them, right? And when I'm an investor in a startup, nobody asks me questions like, why would I do something bad for a startup if I'm an investor, right? You need data? Sure, here is data, right? So I had some investments. I mean, I had many investments that went bankrupt, but I wrote papers based on them. And to me, that's a very, very small price to pay, honestly.
That's a very fresh perspective. So you're it's a true real angel perspective, in the sense of you're doing it for the joy of learning, and then it like kind of it's more than, but it, unlike some, it's less of a, you know, a cocktail conversation. It's actually something that you deliver to your executive MBA classes and through research and stuff. On that
Absolutely.
note, last couple of times we talked, you were, you know, out in San Francisco office of Wharton teaching the exec ed MBAs. So imagine we have an audience here of people who are successful professionals and want to get a little bit of a flavor of Wharton, either from a full-on exec MBA program or, you know, one of the specialist courses. You know, what are some of the nuggets that you could share that would, you know, that you think they would take away, or so you hear some of the other students further in their career take away that would make them want to lean in and explore this?
So I teach in a variety of programs, and some of them are, for example, non-degree short executive classes. I run my own program, which is called Business Model Innovation in the Age of AI. And typical participants that I get there are senior executives who work for big companies that are struggling to reinvent themselves. And so I think if that's something of interest to you, kind of you work for a company which is kind of old, maybe nobody remembers when the business model was invented for this company, which is kind of always a scary thought. I tell
That's like
everyone,
a
like
red flag, you know, that you
red flag, yeah, red flag right there, you know. So that's a good company because we have a very kind of a good group of people. We usually have, I don't know, 25, 35 people discussing various challenges they face in innovating their companies. And so that's kind of the goal of the program, you know, to figure out how to move forward with innovation. And that's what we talk about. I teach also in a program which is called Venture Capital, and that one is much more oriented towards family offices or someone who is moving into venture capital, maybe someone who's just started running a venture capital firm. So it's a very, very different focus. You know, I kind of talk about mostly process of structuring your funnel, you know, screening, investing, and so on.
What are the biggest surprises that people take away after they take your course? Like, and you do, you know, as I'm sure you're doing kind of a little feedback survey of like, what's your biggest takeaway? You know, can you share one for the venture program and maybe one or two for the business model reinvention one?
Sure. So for a business model innovation program, I think one learning that often surprises people is that the biggest barrier to innovation in big companies is not technical, it's culture. It's really to create an innovation in a big company. You run against a culture which does not support experimentation, which does not promote innovation, does not reward for failures, and most innovations are failures. And so that is something that you need to work on to succeed in innovation in a big organization. So it's much more about organizational behavior, which is completely different for startups. For startups, you have the culture of innovation. What you do is experimentation. I mean, you know this as a founder, right? So what fails in startups and what fails in big companies in terms of innovation is very, very different, like very, very different, right?
Okay,
So that's kind of.
so basically not the product market fit thing, which is what we kind of are thinking that that's what, since that's what VCs talk about, that's what makes it very
Yeah,
different.
no, not
Okay.
that. Because for big companies, usually they have, you know, millions of customers, they have billions of dollars in revenues. They see it's relatively easy for them to see that there is something they're not offering, and they can easily kind of come up with a new product offering that their existing customers will buy easily, just because of, you know, long relationships, long-term relationships, and so on. So it's really, really culture, you know. Nobody in big company is rewarded for failing, and that's typically a big problem. And nobody knows how to experiment. People in big companies just don't do that. In most big companies, like why, for example, Amazon is different. Amazon is all about experimentation. So a lot of what I do at Amazon is kind of designing experiments, looking at the results of the experiments, and trying to figure out, is business model A better than business model B, right? In most big companies, nobody does that. So that's why they fail in innovation.
And what about the, I'm an aspiring investor, asset allocator. I want to try to do things more in the entrepreneurial world. What are the challenges there? Or what are the discoveries for people there?
So in a venture capital program, I think big kind of a part that I try to communicate is that this process of innovation, investing in innovation, can be a very mathematical process, very well structured, very mathematical, very kind of by the book. Because a lot of kind of old VC, I think, was like a lot of it was gut feeling or, some kind of a intuition or something like that. I think nowadays you see less of that, and you have to have a process, because you need to evaluate thousands of investments in a very short amount of time. And so making a bunch of decisions using your gut instinct, given all the biases that we know about humans now and all the anchorings and all kinds of other issues, it's just not the right way to go. So you need to structure a process and stick to the process for the whole investment strategy to work.
And do you find that that's psychologically also very hard for people? Because they, like a lot of investors are really, touched by the spirits of FOMO. And, there's still this insight into like, well, if I didn't get a warm introduction, that then these people are not capable of doing something in the market, and all the sort of like rules of the investor mentality. Are you finding that you're countering some of them, or are they?
So absolutely. And this does not invalidate the fact that venture capital is a very people's business, right? So it's a lot about like who you know and how well you know people and what kind of references you get for your deal flow and so on. But still, there should be a kind of a hard process part, where you kind of like, okay, I look at so many companies, and here's a process by which I kind of narrow it down. And this is an important part to kind of build, create, and follow. Nowadays, of course, in venture capital, there is also impact of AI. So you can use all kinds of AI tools to help you screen companies, collect information, evaluate, and so on. But again, you have to create a process for this. So you can hire agents who are going to work with you and help you source companies and help you evaluate companies. And for all of that, you need a process. You need a very, very well-defined process.
So what is the process for somebody who's maybe sort of working full-time programs or kind of specific certificates that we discussed, who's kind of, let's say, mid-career and wants to reinvent themselves? What have you found? Like, I think you're a little, there's a part of you that's going early and part of you that's obviously supporting those senior execs. How do you, what have you found? Is it like internal driven? Is it, yet you need to kind of allocate time and again bring a process-driven framework to reinvention? And this could be as an individual, not just as a company, because I think all of us want to sharpen our saw. So
yeah, it's a great question. I think in academia in particular, you find very often people do and teach the same stuff for 40 years and then they retire, right? So I think academia is like one of the worst places for reinvention. Most people never reinvent themselves. I personally always found it, this kind of approach, boring. To me, it's like every 5-7 years, you need to completely change what you do, like methodology or, kind of a direction and so on. And I think it's probably mostly internally driven. I see, I see most people do not change what they do, right? So I think most people that I know, that probably you know, are very kind of, I found my path and I just kind of follow it. What makes you change it is probably internal drive, I would say. I haven't seen anything. Maybe I haven't thought about like collecting data on this, right?
Well, my personal take on this is that there could be multiple drivers. Sometimes it's a failure that kind of like you're on this road and you think everything is working, and then boom, something doesn't work, and then you have to start re-examining. Sometimes it's you can't cope with the success. Sometimes the success feels hollow when you reached it and you're like, hey, there's got to be a way not just to grow a business, but maybe to grow as a person, as a human being, as part of it. So that I'm really hoping that the business education is going to take more and more of the role of that, kind of what exactly what you're doing with your career, which is why I admire you and excited to share your thoughts with others. Kind of how do you reinvent, how do you add value to others, whether it's for scholarship or applications. And I personally found that, like for me, also a big driver was that I started noticing that where I slipped up as a professional, where I similar places where I slipped up in my family life, as an example, I would be kind of bringing in, some habits as a founder or CEO that maybe were, not as impactful, and I kind of start applying them at home and I'm like, no, that seems to be not working, and so there's all these that I think that's to me the beauty of meeting was kind of a lot of driven, get stuff done people in the world. Eventually they kind of have to make a shift that some of the motivations, the original motivations for drive, need to kind of shift into a service motivation, right? And I think I know Wharton is continuing to do that, and I'm very proud to be associated with the school, very honored that we have a few Wharton faculty like yourself supporting our journey at Relate to AI, and I continue to be a fan of the program. So how can people get to know you, Sergi, your programs, and follow up after this conversation?
Well, professors are very easy to find, right? We have websites with emails and even phone numbers and so on. So I typically respond to people who write to me for a variety of topics. A lot of people write to me for investment or advice on a venture. But send your children to our high school programs for sure. Come to our executive education classes. We have some of the best executive education classes for on any topic. Your education should never stop. If you got a degree, then you have to upskill, you have to update yourself every few years. And we even created for our MBA students, we created a program where every few years you have an executive education program that you can take for free. So it's kind of, you prepay it with your MBA tuition. So we have a lot of MBA students who are coming back to us and taking those programs. And everyone should, you should think about taking executive education program every couple of years, I would say. And you can do it online, but frankly, I personally don't like that format. I prefer much more, talking and networking and making new connections in person. So that's by far the best way to connect.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Sergi. Lifelong learning with Sergi and Wharton. Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relate2.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. We'd love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.